So we are on up to number 440 of Conversations with Yogananda. Yeah, this is class number 121. All right. Oliver Black, to whom the master later gave the title Yogacharya, which means teacher of yoga, was the SRF center leader in Detroit, Michigan. The master described Mr. Black to me as highly advanced spiritually. Yogacharya Oliver told me the following story when I visited him at his home. Yogacharya says, I was visiting Encinitas. Master asked me one day to go out driving with him. Word came that he was just then going out the front door to get into the car. It had been raining hard, and when I received that summons, I glanced out the window a little apprehensively and saw that the rain was pouring down heavily. This seemed hardly the ideal weather for a drive. Moments later, I too exited by the front door to join Master. To my astonishment, not only had the rain stopped completely, but the car and the driveway around it were all perfectly dry. The sun shone brightly in a blue sky. I looked around me unbelievingly for a few seconds. Then I looked at Master. For you, Oliver, he said with a quiet smile. The Master once said to me, Swamiji said, God does not perform overt miracles for people as a rule unless there is an obvious need or for someone who is highly advanced. You know, it's that story, Swami has told that story many times, and I've never exactly known what to think about it. Swami talks about himself when he's trying to tell the same principle. He talks about the time that he was in India, and he grabbed a hold of a microphone boom, and 220 volts went through his body. And just at that moment, I guess your body goes rigid when that kind of electricity goes through, so he couldn't let go. Just at that instant, the fuse blew. So he didn't die. And he sort of, as Swami puts it, you expect God to save your life. You know, if it's not your time to go, something like that. But then Swami tells the other story about when he had a desire for Swiss chocolate. And one of his congregation members just gave him a box, not having any idea that Swamiji had been wanting it and not even knowing that it was his birthday and it came on his birthday. And Swamiji remarked that somehow when Divine Mother looks after you in ways that don't even matter, it's somehow more of a confirmation of her attention to us than the fact that she'll blow a fuse so that you won't die when you have all this work to do in your life. So I think that's what Master must have been doing with Yogacharya, just sort of offering him a little, what would you say, a little confirmation of God's attention to him, of Master's attention to him. You know, what do you give what do you give to the man who is everything? It's not even a question of having it, because it's highly advanced. I mean, what can you do? So they play together. Master talks about God having a sense of humor. Master tells the story of when Jerry Torgerson drilled all the holes in the roof of the desert retreat, and then there was an unexpected rainstorm, and the house was leaking everywhere because there were all these holes in the roof that he hadn't finished the process. And Master said the rain was leaking everywhere except where he was working and in his bedroom. And then he says just at the last, one drop of rain fell on his bare stomach. And it was just like a joke, because just Divine Mother was just having fun. If you think that all the saints enjoy themselves and the masters have a great sense of humor, you would have to ask the question, where did they get it from? I mean, certainly when you look around this planet, you think that God has a sense of humor. Many years ago, this couple spent a little bit of time at Ananda. They long since have gone on their way, and I won't mention their names, and none of you know them. But they were really unique individuals. Odd ducks is actually the only word that you can say. Both of them were just such peculiar and unusual people. And they'd come to the community together, and then after they'd been there for a while, they decided to get married. So Swami was, in those days, Swami performed weddings. So he performed the wedding for them, and on the way, it was held at the seclusion retreat. That was how long ago it was. We were driving up there, and Swami turns to me, and he says, Asha, he says, what do you think is the greatest miracle? That God made someone like her? That God made someone like him? Or that in this vast universe, they found each other? Didn't mean anything untoward by it. He was just speculating and wanted to know what I thought. But God has a sense of humor. You just... Yeah, you just see people. Well, I'm telling funny wedding stories. The other one that I remember, this was again like in the 70s, and it was up at the seclusion retreat, and we didn't know the people. They had just wanted to get married, and at that time Swami was the only minister, so he did the wedding. And when it started, when it was sort of beginning to happen, there was something about the way Swami was relating to them that just seemed a little off. I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And finally, sort of just before it started, he calls me over, and we have this very serious conversation, and he sort of writes a little and speaks a little. And the couple was Chris and Terry. And Swami says, which one is which? And he sort of wanted me to go get a book out of the car, like it looks like he'd forgotten something, and then write who was who on the whole thing. So he depended on me because I did know those things. I had to keep a very straight face. And just a moment, Asha's getting something for me, and I got it. And after that, then he was able to go ahead. Oh, dear. Okay, moving right along. But really, I mean, God has a sense. People have a sense of humor, and saints really have a sense of humor. So what are the chances that God doesn't have a sense of humor? You know, when you really think about it, why wouldn't he make jokes? Why wouldn't he think that things are amusing? I mean, you look at some of God's creatures, and you really think, they're just like, what was he thinking? When I was in seclusion writing the book about Swami Lightbearer, I guess it was the spring, and there are a lot of wild turkeys. I was up near Ananda Village, and one of the turkey mothers had 10 little turkey babies, which are really, turkey mothers are not attractive except to other turkeys, but turkey babies, really nobody could love but their mother. They are the ugliest, weirdest looking little things, you know? But there they are. It's just really like, what was he thinking? Yeah. But that's it. They must really, because everything, I mean, this is just, Swami talks about how everything's done through instruments, and you know, great souls are involved. Do you think they're not having fun? Like, what is the logic of something like the way a turkey looks? And then they can be so beautiful when they spread their tails. I mean, there's lots of creatures that are so odd. What possible reason could there be except education and entertainment, as Master says? I'm just speculating. I have no answers to any of that. Okay. 441. The master taught in his lessons. Oh, just a second. You know, the other part of it that I did want to say is, you know, Swamiji, Master emphasizes that friendship is the highest form of love, because it's uncoerced. And so that's the relationship we're going to have with God. And the relationship with a friend, the definition of it is that it's a relationship of equality. If there's other care, and it's a relationship of relaxation and of friendship, it's completely reciprocal. When I said something to Swami that was a little cheeky, I think is probably the best word I can think of, just... He allowed, we were very relaxed, and he said something and I made some sort of joking remark back. Then I got a little nervous, like, I mean, I'd been treating Swami that way all for years, but suddenly I became anxious that maybe it wasn't appropriate. And I asked Swamiji if he had ever teased Master, because Swami was quite a tease. And he said, oh no, I was much too in awe of him. He said, when I knew Ananda Moy Ma later, he said, I was relaxed enough to have that kind of humorous give and take with her. He said, but with Master, I was too much in awe of him at all time. I said, well, did anybody have that relationship with Master? He said the only one he ever saw was Dr. Lewis, because they met when they were both young men in their 20s. And also, you have to think, there was no context when Master met Dr. Lewis, except the context of Dr. Lewis's having a cosmic experience and knowing that Master had given it to him. But still, there was no context. He was a Massachusetts dentist. He wasn't a world traveler. He was a Rosicrucian, so by no means was he not Dr. Lewis. I mean, he was deep into metaphysics. But nonetheless, and there was, Master had no ashram. There was no autobiography of a yogi. There was nothing. And they were in their mid-20s together. So he said Dr. Lewis had that kind of relationship with Master, but a relationship just of friends, because that's what they were. It's fascinating to think about it. So that was also, Master was just, oh, I'll do something nice for Oliver. I'll stop the rain and make the sunshine because I can, and it'll be just for him. We'll just, as Swami puts it, that Master could change the dream, which is an interesting way to put it, in our sleep. Have you ever had the experience in a dream where you've just been able to change it? Every once in a while I've had it. Swami said he had a dream once in which some character came in and started spoiling the story. So he just backed the dream up to the point where that character entered and then didn't have him enter and then just went on with the dream. The playwright, you know, he was just editing the dream because it was kind of a nuisance. So, number 441, any comments or thoughts before we go on? The Master taught in his lessons that shaking hands with people creates an exchange of magnetism. That, no doubt, is why the traditional greeting in India is the palm-folded gesture, the namaskar, instead of the handshake. Nevertheless, he had me stand outside the Hollywood church after his Sunday services and shake hands with the people as they left. Perhaps because they were drawing consciously from me as Master's disciple, I felt dizzy and weak afterward. Later, I mentioned this problem to Master. That is because you are thinking of yourself, he replied. Think of God and feel God's power flowing through you. Then you will be all right. Following his advice, I never again felt drained of energy when shaking hands after the service. Rather, I felt more inspired. I was thinking of what Swami says, what we say every week in the Festival of Light. Pain is the fruit of self-love, whereas joy is the fruit of love for God. And so Master, you know, even though Master talks about this exchange and how you have to be careful, when you have the greater magnetism influences the lesser. And I'm sure Master One wanted to use Swamiji as a channel, but he also, because of the life Swami had to leave. Now, Swami, now he's 24. He's just come to Master. He's just a very young man, and he's very new at all of this. But Master's putting him forward right away. You know, I'm not going to do it, but you're going to do it, and you're going to do it for me. So he was training Swamiji in so many different ways to really understand how to actually be a channel in this way. You know, being a channel for the inspiration of the Masters is a very, it's a golden opportunity. It's a tremendous God-given opportunity, but it's a very subtle practice. And let me think how to say it. I mean, self-forgetfulness is what realization is about. It's not, oh, I feel so inspired. It's that there's just nobody there. Haridas, who was very good at, has been very good at just coining phrases, when somebody would compliment him on a class or something, his response would be, oh yes, something inspiring happened and I got to be there. Which is really a very exact and accurate way to say it, which is something inspiring happened and I got to be part of it. Because if you are genuinely attuned and are genuinely expressing inspired consciousness, there is nobody there to be doing it. Now, of course, there is a matter of degree on that, but there's not a sort of self-conscious sense of, oh, how exhilarating it is when I get to be a channel. Oh, I love doing this. Swami used to say, he never put anyone in a position of public responsibility who wanted it or who enjoyed it. And I mean, that you have to understand that he doesn't mean that you should feel miserable. That's not what he meant. But who was looking for their own satisfaction in that experience. And you see, it's paradoxical because on one hand, it's extremely gratifying to be able to share with others what you know. And so naturally, if you didn't have a desire to do it, you wouldn't be doing it. Or if you didn't have an appreciation of the opportunity, you wouldn't be accepting it. Although, Emily, think about that, because Swami said he was very reluctant. Master put him forward and just made him be a public person when he didn't have any wish to be. He would complain even that he would rather sit with his eyes closed when he was in the presence of Master, but Master would direct almost all his conversation right at Swami. You know, Swami doesn't say things like that often, but he commented on it. When I spoke to Swami's cousin, Bette Hover, like 20 years ago, when I first was going to write about Swami, I interviewed his relatives, thinking I was going to write a book. Well, I did. Actually, I did. There's a chapter in Swami Kriyananda as we have known him from those interviews. But Bette said to me, she met Swami, she saw Swami with Master, I think on more than one occasion. And she said, the phrase he used was, Swami was the apple of his eye. And I said, how did you know that? She says, oh, it was just obvious, like that. And later I went to Swami, because Swami had never said anything like that at all. I said, sir, this is what Bette said about you. And so very quietly Swami says, oh, yes, I was. Just like that, because Master really saw what he had in Swamiji and poured energy into him all the time. So he wants him to stand up here and learn whatever it is he needs to learn to get out of the way to allow Master simply to work through him. Because that's how the Master's living presence is kept alive, by the living presence of those who are in tune with him. That's how it works. So all of us have this enormous responsibility, and whether that responsibility ever rises to the level of anybody recognizing it because you have position or something like that, it doesn't make your responsibility any less or any more. Each person simply does what they're able to do. You know, and a person who has the capacity to serve in a certain way will be asked to serve in that way. Or, phrase it more differently, it's not even the capacity, where it's karmically appropriate. You know, Sister Gyanamata, who was brilliant in every way, Master never had her do any public work. Swami wanted her to write articles for the magazine, and she just never even responded to his request. Because there was no karmic reason for her to do that anymore. Rajasi had been running a meditation group in St. Louis, is that where he lived? Kansas City. And Master said to close it. And you would think, well, he could help all those people, but not in that way. That wasn't his way that he was supposed to do it. So there's no hierarchy. It's just each person has what they have to give. Remember Swami talking about being with Yogi Ramya in India, Master saying, if I had spent 30 more minutes in his company, I could never have brought myself to leave India. Swami spending 4 days with him. And he had essentially no outward mission, just a few disciples, and he lived quietly in this village, and nobody knew who he was. The way he talked about it, he when he interacted with his neighbors, they mostly talked about food. But Swami said, with all that you have, why aren't you doing more? God is doing what he wants through this body. So it's very... The only question is that we not hold back out of lack of energy, lack of courage, or lack of willingness. We can't just say, oh, it doesn't matter, if that statement is self-protective. So, I mean, when people ask me various questions, I usually just ask them, are you operating at 100% of who you are? And if you're not, then you need to find a way to serve more and to do more. Because we won't grow unless we're you know, if we stay within the comfortable sphere of where our energy naturally flows, how will we ever grow? I put it, if you go to the gym and you only ever put the weights on the machine that are the weights that you can already lift effortlessly, why would you even spend your time doing it? And so we have to exercise our spiritual muscles, and in order to exercise them, we have to add weight to the machine. We have to willingly take on. It doesn't have to look like anything. It can be a greater dedication to your career. It can be more serviceful to your own family. It can be taking up painting. I mean, it can be any number of things that allow the power of the spirit to work through you in a way that is bigger than you already know. Whatever it might be, just bigger than what you already know. And there's phases of life. You know, one reaches a certain stage where the body just won't do what it used to do. Or the spirit is just not inclined in the same way to do the same things. I read a very interesting article about brain development. It was written by a businessman, I think, or something like that. But it was talking about how the brain and the inclination, it was like they were reaching for the four ashrams of yoga. But they were talking about it from the point of view of how the brain works and how just at certain decades of life, the brain works in a certain way. And as you get older, your brain isn't as outwardly focused or creatively focused or innovatively focused. And they talked about what a mistake it is, because a person will spend four decades arriving to a certain pinnacle and then they'll hold their position for another 20 years, even though at that point they're no longer actually effective in that position because their whole orientation has shifted, which we see all the time. And this man actually resigned, the man who wrote the article, he resigned from the peak position he had reached because he realized that he was no longer appropriate for that position because his whole way of thinking about life had shifted into something else. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that's the four ashram stages where you just, at a certain point, you just, I'm done with that. Now I go off and do the next thing in my world. Life does not always support us financially or emotionally to do those things. But I certainly, at the stage that I'm in, I just feel different about things. Fortunately, I have lots of energy and lots of creative ideas about what else to do. But it shows up in small ways. Like I used to organize a lot of Swami's tours and a lot of his traveling. I used to organize my own tours. I just can't do it. It's like my brain is still, I'm as mentally sharp, I believe, as I've ever been. But when somebody asks me to just make up a topic for a class, it's like they've asked me to fly to the moon. It's just like, I just can't think about it. I said, you just tell me whatever you want. You just tell me what to do and all. And I remember Swami was like that. You just tell me whatever the topic is, that's fine with me. Because there's I sort of say to people, like the DNA has dried up. The whole aspect of my personality, which was my youth, my younger personality, it's just dried up. It's just not there. But when we continue to seek, then we can keep going. And then here's, you know, then we continue to always think that this is something flowing through me, this isn't me. And I can't take responsibility, and I can't even, I can be humbly grateful. I can't even be exhilarated by it. I just have to be humbly grateful. And then it continues. Otherwise, a little something weird comes in. Number 442. Well, Swami says he became dizzy and weak. We're lucky if we become dizzy and weak when we're out of tune. I mean, that's just great. I feel dizzy and weak because I'm out of tune. Wouldn't that be fabulous? You know, then you could just tell. Oh. Sometimes it does come like that. Although usually something just whacks you in the head. Just something, you're just walking along and all of a sudden, oh my gosh. Okay. 442. You know, the oddest thing happened to me. This is not about attunement, but it's so funny how karma just hits you. I was walking across the playground out here outside the church, and all of a sudden, at my feet was this sort of greeny rubber ball, And I have no idea. The next thing I knew, my feet were totally tangled up in the ball, and I was flat on the ground with a very, really satisfying whack when the back of my head hit the ground. But it was just like, how did that happen? Because I'm not stupid enough to step on the ball. Like, what happened? But karma just takes over. You know, I'm standing up. It was necessary for me to fall over backwards. I've hit my head 3 times in places and ways that I just have never done it before. On the stairwell going up to the choir loft, I have no idea. I have no idea how I did it. I hit my head. I hit my head on my car door. You know, I have no idea how I do it. And then this ball came at my feet and knocked me onto the ground. Actually, the car door was the third one, because I was becoming a little concerned, because they say that it comes in threes. So actually, as soon as I hit the car door, I said, oh, number three. And I felt like it's over now. You know, it was like here, 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 3 times, bang like that. But how does it happen? It's like Divine Mother, there was no conscious thought on my part. I saw it, and then I fell. But I'm not that stupid. But God just takes charge of our life all the time. That was super mitigated karma, because I went down hard, but nothing happened. Except I just sort of lay there and thought, huh, this is really interesting. Here I am on the ground. When I fell off my bicycle, I was wearing the bicycle helmet, and my head went wumpa, 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 wumpa like this. And I remember as I was bouncing thinking, huh, that's why we wear bicycle helmets. But without the helmet, I just went whack and just lay there and thought, that was quite, I thought, wow, that was quite a sound. I didn't know that one's head could make such a sound. I'd heard such things before. So then I had to just lay there and see if there was anything wrong, which there wasn't. But strange, isn't it? We're just so vulnerable. Just absolutely vulnerable. I'm walking across the playground, then I'm flat on the ground. I could have cracked my head open. Who knows? Why, we have to be in the presence of God every single minute. Because it could be our last, or we could be on the edge of some enormous karmic shift, or some karmic cloud can be following us. Who knows what it is? You just have to always be current, is the way I like to think about it. I'd like to just stay current. Whatever it is, I like to be on it. I don't like to wait. I don't like to have it build up. I don't like to think, oh, I'll deal with that some other time. I mean, if it's real. Just little stuff, you can't help it. Okay. Questions or comments before we continue? Number 442. A man came to Mount Washington and was accepted by the master for training. The man received Kriya Yoga initiation and practiced it with great fervor for a few months. Once he told me he meditated for a full day and night without a break. Impatient, however, with the seeming slowness of his progress, he left the master at last in discouragement. Incredible, isn't it? Commenting later on this devotee, the master told me, he will never find God that way. He's like a merchant who says, Lord, I have given you so many kriyas, now you have to keep your side of the bargain and give me so much realization. God never responds to such mercenary devotion. He accepts nothing less from us than our unconditional love. Swami writes, I wondered if it wasn't of him that Master was thinking when he wrote in his Gita commentaries of some people who meditate with great willpower but without devotion, and who abandon their spiritual practices in time. Because you're putting out all this energy for the gold medal, and the gold medal doesn't come. You don't get picked for the team. You don't get chosen. You don't get what you want. You know, this this is the trend. The forecasts, the way Swami explained them, are so incredibly helpful. And the Shudra caste, which is the peasant caste, which is not where we would be if we're on the spiritual path. You have to be more creative. We're not talking about professions. We're talking about attitudes toward life. The Shudra consciousness is not creative, and it doesn't initiate. It merely acts, puts out as little energy as possible to avoid catastrophe, and that's all that it will do. The Vaishya consciousness, which is the merchant consciousness, is when we begin to realize that if I put out energy, I get something back in return. So we rise from the Shudra because now we are willing to put out energy. Now we're willing to take initiative. We're not just trying to avoid punishment. We're actually trying to create. But all of our thinking is what's in it for me. It's like, if I really do this, I'm going to get rich. If I really do this, people are going to like me. Even charitable giving can be in order that my name will be known and that everybody will think highly of me. It's always weighing and measuring. And you can be quite dynamic and advanced and advanced in the world, make a great deal happen, even to a certain extent spiritually, but there's always that thought of self. And this goes back to true spirituality is when there is no thought of self. It's just self-forgetfulness. But the Vaishya is always weighing and measuring. And so it's not... And if you think of the relationship with God, if you think of our time with God as a relationship, this is one of the most important things to realize, which is why Master personifies God as Divine Mother, why the Divine incarnates in the form of these extraordinarily lovable saints and masters whose life stories or whose personalities are so magnetic to us because of my and our recent travels to Israel. The whole reality of who Jesus is and what his life means has been so vivid for so many of us recently. And it's like there's this living relationship with this person. It's not this abstraction of the divine. There's this person who's walking with us and that we're talking to and that we're having a life with. And our relationship with God is just a refined extension of our relationship with anyone in the world, any human relationship we have. So think about it. In a relationship you have where you're always measuring, I cooked yesterday, you have to cook today. I took the garbage out, I'm just going to let it pile up until you take it out. You know, here's my half, here's much I've spent on groceries, and then this is what you have to spend on groceries. You know, why am I the one who always has to? It's just like, how magnetic is that? It's just like it's never any fun if people are keeping score all the time. I mean, people do run relationships in an exceedingly Vaishya manner, where they're always keeping score. What am I getting? How much am I giving? And what am I getting back? There's a horrible energy these days as women appropriately try to assert themselves, but they start weighing and measuring everything. I was very amused. There was a book, came out years ago. It was Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And it was just the weird interplay of the male-female dynamic. And one of the sections in that book that I really remembered was that men and women keep score differently, is how it was put. A man says, I bought a house. You know, that's worth a lot. I put the kids through college. That's worth a lot. And he kind of feels that like he's accumulating a certain number of points that will stand him in good stead. He said, a woman, everything is one. He bought a house. That's 1 point. He forgot my birthday. That's a minus 1 point. And everything else that was done is just wiped off. And that's just the way it is. And he's very confused because he thinks he should have a little margin here. But it's all one as far as she's concerned. I mean, and it's true. It's actually true because women get in the moment and so on like that. But just the whole idea of keeping score. But what I was starting to say is, as women try to stand up for themselves, whether or not this is helpful or not is a whole nother discussion. Standing up for yourself is helpful. Being Vaishya in your relationships is not helpful. So if we're always male or female, thinking about what we're getting and finding out and looking at someone and seeing whether they're doing what I want them to do, it gets very difficult. And if we think about God that same way, it gets very complicated. Because after the Vaishya level comes the Kshatriya level. And the Kshatriya, the image is the soldier king. where I know my duty, and I live for an ideal, and I discipline myself to that ideal. I discipline myself to do what is right. And it's not vaisya, I'm not trading. And the difference also is the vaisya needs the external world to be a certain way for the vaisya to feel safe, safe and happy. So it's very necessary at the vaisya level that the environment always be responsive to the person's individual needs. You know, it has to be a certain way or else I'm unhappy. And a tremendous amount of even social activism and political activism is really just the vaisya needing the world to be a certain way and then determined to force the world to be a certain way because I don't feel good as long as until that has changed. The kshatriya realizes that I discipline myself. The world is never going to satisfy me because it's the nature of it that it won't, that it can't. So where I find my security and my happiness is in self-discipline. And then one finds what is the principle that one is going to discipline oneself to. This was what my Sunday service was about. When I was talking about from the time you wake up in the morning till you go to bed at night, if you're a devotee, you're always disciplining yourself. You're always, and it doesn't necessarily look hard and austere, but you're always choosing. You're always choosing to at least in the direction of, even if it's not very well done, even if you're only giving it a glance just before you do the wrong thing, but at least you're looking over there and you know it's there. You know, you're just always trying to match the ideal. And you do that inside yourself because it's the right thing to do. And so you may decide that these friends are too selfish for you to enjoy because it's too unbalanced a relationship and it's not anything that you want because they never give, they only take. So it's not like you have to be a doormat or a fool, but you just simply observe, you know, that this is what these people are like, and if it doesn't uplift me to be in their company, I don't have to be in their company. You don't behave inappropriately. You know what's right, and then you simply do what's right. So when we get onto the spiritual path, it's very complicated because, you know, we have these things we're supposed to do. We promise that we'll do the kriya. We're supposed to do the affirmations, the energization exercises, all this. And there is sort of an implied that we'll get something from it. We're going for God realization. We'll become happier. Everything in future will improve. All of these things will sort of cross our minds. So we have to go through this shifting where our spiritual path is not vaisya. If I was alone in the world and getting nothing back from it, and that's so often why we have these long dry spells or these very difficult periods where nothing really goes right because Divine Mother is asking, are you a vaisya or a kshatriya? Even more, are you a Brahmin? Are you doing it just for God? Or are you doing it because you're going to get a certain amount of reward? So this is what Master said. Certain people go at it with great willpower, but often they're going at it with great willpower because in the back of their minds, I'll just do this and then I'll get liberated. It's not, I'm doing this because this is my nature. This pleases God. This is who I am. This is my duty. This is the right way to live. It's internal. One begins to just see it very differently. And then it's like there's no success or failure. It's like it doesn't matter what happens. Like, what else am I going to do? This is where Peter's remark to Jesus was so powerful. When Jesus was challenging his disciples with such a difficult teaching, eat my body and drink my blood. And a lot of the disciples were just bailing because the poor rabbi had lost his mind as far as they could see. You know, his teaching had made a lot of sense and suddenly it was crazy. So Jesus asked Peter if he's going to abandon him too. Yeah, it was an obvious question. Everybody else is going, Peter, what about you? Look, there aren't as many here anymore. Are you going to hang out? And I'm sure a lot of Peter's friends left. I mean, think of it in a human way. People he depended on, that he liked, that he expected to stay. we've all lived, I've lived 50 years at Ananda, I've seen a lot. You know, people that I thought were rocks, well, that's not true. There's, with very few exceptions, there's almost no one who's left that was a surprise in the sense that it was inexplicable. You know, you just, all of us have bad, I have to say this in the correct way, all of us have terrible faults, and all of us have terrible bad attitudes. But over time, you work your way through them. But then sometimes you see that people sort of get stuck on one, and they don't understand that it's a bad attitude. The way I always say it is they play the edges. I've watched people play the edges, which is, you know, I need to give everything to God, but I'm not going to quite give this. And it's not even, it's a difference between saying I'm not ready to do it and thinking I don't have to do it. You can say I'm not ready. You can say I just don't have the courage. I just don't have the courage to do it. And I know someday I will. I mean, I've shared with you at other times, sometimes I've been really mad at God because I knew I had to do it. That was extremely annoying to me. I wanted a way to not have to go the distance. And I was left without a choice. But then sometimes people will pretend that their attitudes are just fine. But I call that they lower the top of the mountain so they'll feel more comfortable where they're standing. You can be perfectly comfortable where you're standing, but just always know that it's where you're standing. It's not the top of the mountain. So when Jesus said to Peter, are you also going to leave me? Peter said, where could I go? Meaning, there is no reality. It doesn't matter to me, even if it makes any sense. This is just what I have to do. He was a total, he totally transcended at that point the Vaishya idea. He was a Kshatriya. He was a devotee because it was in the fitness and the rightness of things that he would do it, and he knew what he was doing. He knew what the ideal was, and he absolutely couldn't go against it. It's just like that. You know, this is very small, but when my parents were older, I wrote them a few letters. I wanted them to feel happy about the lives that they'd lived. And I don't know what prompted it, but I wrote a letter about all three of us, the three children, because my parents put very strong moral and ethical guidelines into our nature. And I remember writing, I said, I can't even drop a gum wrapper on the sidewalk. You know, I can't even litter. I just can't. Because as soon as I do, I know it's wrong and I just have to go and pick it up again. You know, and it's a tiny and a silly thing, but that's how we want to be. I just can't. I just can't. So then if God is nice to you, that's great. If you get everything you want, that's super. But if you don't, it doesn't cross your mind that there's something else to do. Where would I go? In fact, Swamiji said, for success on the spiritual path, you should cultivate that attitude every day. Every day you should remind yourself of what you're doing and why you're doing it and that there is no other choice. So that if things get tough and you imagine for a moment that it would be easier if I just left the path behind, there won't be any place in you where you can do that. Ekavir.
Yeah, how about the fear of the fear of leaving the path?
Well, you know, it's really in your hands. I know people do get afraid because you do hear weird stories, even what I said. But, you know, it doesn't happen to you. It happens little by little because you begin to have the wrong attitude. So you just pay attention. Why am I on the path? What am I doing? What do I really believe? What else would I do with my life? Don't be afraid of those questions. Just ask those questions over and over. What else would I do? Where would I go? Why would I think it was better? And when longing arises in your heart, you know, I've never had, well, now I live in this house, but I've never, I say it like that. I've learned to appreciate this house I live in because it's so weird, because the last thing I ever wanted in my life was a house like the house I live in. I just have never wanted it. And I have explicitly not wanted it. But let's just say, you know, you just you live humbly, and then you see somebody has a beautiful home, and a piece of you wants to have that house. You know, you see somebody with a little family, and you think, oh, if only I could have that family. You see someone who has an important career. Don't be afraid of those things. Don't run away from them. Just look right at it. Well, what would that give me? What do I think I would get from that? Is it worth it to me? What would I have to give up? There was a point when I was at Ananda in the late 70s, and I was living in my little trailer that I'd been in forever. And one day, it just crossed my mind that this really wasn't a good environment for me anymore. I just needed something else. And I had absolutely no money and not the slightest way of manifesting anything else. Absolutely, it was just out of the question. So I asked myself, because I was perfectly capable, I knew, of earning as much money as I ever wanted to earn. And if I really wanted to have a house or a this or a that, I could go and get it. It wasn't like I couldn't go and get it. But in order to go and get it, I would have to leave the life that I was living. But I remember I just, you know, I looked at it. I wasn't afraid to look at it. Is it worth it to me? And I decided, no, actually it isn't. But then a year or two later, all of a sudden I was living completely differently. And it just happened to me because my intuition was correct. But every time one of those longings comes, don't run away from it. Because then it won't build up subconsciously. Because otherwise it builds up subconsciously and then suddenly it ambushes you. And like me in that little rubber ball, all of a sudden you just find yourself somewhere and you don't really know what happened in between. But if we stay awake and we pay attention, and even if we say, well, Divine Mother, I need a life partner. I really want to have children. I don't have enough money. I need to travel. Whatever it is, just say it out loud. And then see what happens. And then you have to make choices. Which way, what am I going to do? That's how you avoid, to use a few examples that I know, you know, one man who really is really part of Ananda, but he left. He just kept track all the time of unfair thing that ever happened to him. It was just stunning. And every time he would get annoyed, he would bring out the whole list. And, you know, just like I just couldn't believe he was keeping track, but he was always keeping track. And he was never thinking the Divine Mother was in charge, and if these things happened to me, maybe there was a good reason. You know, just blatant wrong attitudes. Does that make sense? I can give other examples, but it's on like that. Okay, let's take a little break then. Let's take 5 minutes. You know, another aspect of the transition between Vaishya and Kshatriya is even the desire for liberation. It's a little bit tricky, that one. Because even the thought, you know, I will be liberated, can become an egoic, I'm doing this for what I get. So it's a fine line. There's some place in the Bhagavad Gita commentary, and I am now doing the commentary page by page, and when I find it, I will make a big note because I can't find it again. Swami has about 2 paragraphs that says, oh, don't think about your liberation. Don't be so self-preoccupied that you're worried about it. Just do what you need to do. And when he wrote that, when I read it, I said to him, sir, this has always seemed to me like a point worth making. Because even though Swami himself has urged us to become Jivan Muktas and said you can become a Jivan Mukta, you can become free in this life. I mean, he doesn't need to be consistent. He can say different things at different times because it depends on what the audience needs and what's needed in the moment. But there can be I'm doing this for what I can get, even in the desire to be liberated. And that can become a slightly Vaishya way of thinking about it. I mean, if there was no liberation at the end of it, would I not do it? I mean, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I serving? Why am I meditating? Why am I trying to live according to high ideals? Is it because of what I can get? Or is it for the sheer rightness and joy of doing it? Yes, Ekavir. Could you give the microphone to him, please?
Uh-huh. Just how about the desire just to be happy? Is that a Vaishya?
Depends on how you go about it. Let me just think about it. There is what's known as a desireless desire. The desire for liberation is not a desire, because that which will be the end of all desires, there can't be ego in that, in the desire that wishes to transcend the ego. So it's not egoic to want to transcend the ego. So it's not so much the thought itself, it's really basically what is motivating a person to think that way. Am I always saying, I'm doing this because I know I'm going to get, or am I doing this because it's right and isn't it wonderful? Look how happy I am. You know, it's like it's the grace of God. I'm grateful. I'm grateful to God for what He gives me, and I'm always grateful to God for whatever He gives me. And these are like the attitudes you have to confront in yourself. I mean, I had this idea that, I don't know why, I just thought it would get easier. And I really started thinking about, or that there would be smooth sailing. You know, recently, as we all know, we've been having to deal with a lot of insecurity in the fundamentals of our community life because of the ownership of the property, which has suddenly become very complicated. And I had to go through a lot of, but I thought it was settled. You know, I thought it was done. I'm 72 years old. Why am I having to deal with this? You know, I spent all this time helping to establish this, and I just wanted to just kick back and enjoy it. So there's just these levels of thinking that become entitlement and become vaishya. Instead of why on earth would he make it easy for me? Why would he not continue to ask me to grow? That's what I finally had to think. Why would he not keep asking me to grow? And some part of me thought that he wouldn't, because I'd already done a lot. I did Colin a favor when my mother, after 15 years of Parkinson's, and what happens at the end, for her at least, it started giving her seizures. And she only lived a month from the first seizure to her death, and it was the grace of God. And she had one of these seizures when I was there, and we had to go to the emergency room, and we were in the little chamber with the little curtain around us, and my poor mama was just curled up on the bed there. I called all the masters into the room, and I could see them. I lined them all up in chairs. And I said, basically, I've done a lot for you, and I need a favor now. You know, which is, this is not an option. You know, you're not going to torture this woman like this. And within like 10 days, she died, which was good, because it just, you know, all of a sudden her life was becoming untenable. It had been challenging, but in a positive way. But that's the only time I ever really said, you owe me, because I felt they did. But it was a lover's quarrel, you know, to insist on that. This is not an option. But those little habits come in when we started having to deal with all that we've had to deal with locally with the community. Part of me was just like, oh, come on, give me a break. And like, why? Why would he give me a break? So you just have to ask. That's how you stay on the path. You stay on the path not because you don't have wrong attitude, but when wrong attitude comes, you relate to it honestly. And even if you say, I'm still mad about this, it's a lover's quarrel. It's okay. I just don't appreciate the way you're treating me. I just want you to know it. I feel the need to speak my mind at this point, that this is not an option. And then, of course, if it continues, you realize, well, I guess it is an option after all.
But at least we're still having that conversation.
You're still having the conversation. You're still in relationship. So you think about it being a relationship. And, you know, I'm having a hissy fit right now, which I have had on more than one occasion. And I've remained upset for longer than a minute. I mean, for a lot longer than a minute. But I've always known that I was going to have to get over it. I mean, God knows, I don't know my own delusions. I don't mean to exaggerate this. I mean, the nature of delusion is you don't know it's a delusion. But, yeah, of course, because if you knew it was a delusion, you would at least be talking about it. But when dissonance comes, one makes a serious effort to see it from the right point of view. Even if one is not able to live up to it, at least you can name it. And you pray, I want to get over this. I remember once realizing how much I enjoyed being annoyed with certain people in my life. And I really had to admit it, that I really enjoyed it in a perverse way. And so then the prayer became, I want to get over this. Because I realized my prayer to get over it was not really sincere. But I did want to. And I just didn't want to. If you could follow that. But then you're not deluding yourself. You're not pretending that I could get away from this by going over here. See, that's where Peter's comment, where would I go? Because you build up in your mind that there's an option, that I could actually go do something else and I could escape. But how could you? And the deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper you recognize that consciousness, my consciousness, is inescapable, and the only solution is to resolve it. Period. Just period. And there is no exceptions to that. And the more powerful you know it, where would I go? Where could I possibly go that my consciousness wouldn't follow me, and sooner or later I'd be standing right here? Oh yeah, you can drink and you can, you know, spend money and you can do all kinds of things, but eventually there's going to be the moment when you're there again. That was when I came onto the path, like when I was 18 or something. I just remember this night. In my mind, I feel like I was awake all night, but it's highly unlikely that I was. But I remember throughout the night, I kept looking for an alternative. And the way it focused in on me was, no matter what kind of life I lead, no matter how much I accomplish, no matter how many people, no matter anything, there will be the moment of death. I mean, these are yogic samskaras. There will be the moment of death. At that point, I'd never been with anyone who died. I didn't know anything about death. There will be the moment of death, and I will be absolutely alone. And who will I be in that moment? And I could just feel that everything was of no consequence except who would I be in that moment, because that's what it would all come down to. Now, of course, I got much more sophisticated over these decades in all my understanding of that, but I spent a long evening looking for an alternative to it finally coming down to my consciousness, and I could not find it. I mean, I was already starting on the spiritual path, but that was like, where would I go? And that's what keeps you on the path, is where would I go? Because it's just an illusion to think, oh, well, I didn't get it from meditating, I'll go look for something else. You're just postponing the inevitable when you just come back. You can go, this man came to Swami, he was a journalist, he was a Gemini, he presented himself as a Gemini. He said, you know, I get really enthusiastic. This was like in the 70s, this was in the candy store period of all this spiritual stuff coming forward. He was a writer for Yoga Journal, actually. And he said, you know, I when I meet a new teacher or something and I start a new set of practice, I'm so enthusiastic and it's so much fun. And I do this for a while and then gradually I lose interest and I come back in here and then I find another one and I do it like this. And he sort of said, you know, don't seem to be getting anywhere, or it feels so positive when I'm doing it, but it doesn't seem to lead anywhere. And Swami said, yes, going in circles gives you a certain sense of accomplishment. He said, the bigger the circle, the greater the sense of accomplishment. But ultimately, you have to just go forward. And that's sort of what that night, whenever that night was, it was like everything else was just going to be a circle, because no matter how big and complicated it was, I would die. And when I died, I would just have my consciousness. So what are you going to really, you know, what are you going to devote your life to? I said, ooh, I think I better devote my life to consciousness, because the rest of it is ephemeral. The you know, what you were singing, the things of this world last only an hour. What's the word? What's the phrase? What's the song? The comfort they bring you. Yes, the comfort it brings you lasts hardly an hour. I was really thinking about that today. Hardly an hour. Like a whole lifetime, it's hardly an hour. Yeah. Just, because that is what it feels like, because when that moment of death comes, and, or that moment of liberation, or that moment of transcendent experience, all of a sudden we see it all in perspective. And, you know, it's just so, the words of the masters are so wildly divergent from the ego's experience. Because the ego is just having a wholly different experience. But the masters keep reminding us that none of this actually is what it seems. And the only thing that's enduring is when we are in contact with the infinite. Now, the life that we live, and thank you, God, is really rich with divine experiences. Because we have community, and we have satsang, and we have each other, and we have so many opportunities. So we have real, real experiences, is what I mean. Because so many people in the world, my goodness, they just, you know, I'm sure you all know it. When I was buying gas the other day, I kept hearing this noise, and I realized that the gas pump was talking to me. It was giving me news and then asking me to buy things. I just thought, please, just give me a couple of minutes. Let me just fill my gas tank. What a planet. That might be the end of tonight's class. I don't think we can top that, so we probably should just stop here. All right, is there anything else that we need to talk about? Or have we done it? Okay, so tonight we went from number 440 through number 442. Okay.